You're listening to 42 Macros Pro to Pro Live, hosted by Darius Dale.
Howdy, Team 42. It's your skipper here, Darius Dale, to present another episode of Pro to Pro Live. I'm joined with my friend, our fan, a fan favorite of our crowd and our community, Luke Groman, founder and CEO of Forest for the Trees. How you doing today, Luke?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you, Darius?
I'm doing exceptional, man. Appreciate you you joining us. I was saying to you and off camera, you're one of my favorite people to follow in our space. And the reason for that is, you know, I feel like, you know, you're doing a real service for the world from the perspective of like Morpheus in the Matrix, if you will. You're sort of breaking the matrix and you're offering investors this sort of red pill versus blue pill choice. Whereas the blue pill was the, I don't know, CPI did this and Fed's going to do that and rinse repeat every month. And we'll keep talking about those same two things for the next, you know, indefinite amount of time. And then there's the red pill, which is, hey, we're in a great, an era of great social, economic and institutional change. And even though we don't have all the answers of how, you know, where we're going to wind up, let's try to put together a defensible, robust research process to identify those changes and hopefully profit from those changes as an investor. So I assume that's why you named your company Forest for the Trees. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly why it is. My background is I spent almost 20 years in institutional equity research and then institutional equity research sales. And it was a fun, awesome, wonderful world to be involved in, particularly in the years I was there. I started in, call it 95. The firm started with an old line Cleveland money management firm that had a sell side business and then was an early employee and then early partner at Midwest Research. Nice. And we were early pioneers in bottoms up fundamental channel check research. And what does that mean is, when I came into the business, 95, 96, 97, a research call was analysts would cover 10, 15 companies, pick up the phone, call the IR guy, the CFO or the CEO and talk about business trends and then hang up the phone, write up a note, send it out to clients. And then the sales guys would pick up the phones and call clients. And that was how the business worked. And we did a lot by virtue of our location of industrial and cyclical type names. And this all works fine when everything's going well. All right, so the economy's going well, business is going well, pick up the phone, CFO, IR guy says, hey, yeah, everything's going great. Fall of 97, you have the Asian crisis. By spring of 98, the industrial cyclical world is in a severe recession.
Totally.
And what we started to find was that when you pick up the phone and ask the IR and CFO, hey, how's business? They don't tell you the truth when things start to go bad. They lie. Not necessarily out of, you know, they're bad people per se. There's, you know, some of it's human nature, some of it's securities laws, right? As time went on, like you couldn't, you know, the Reg FD was, you know, you couldn't tell people unevenly that you're going to miss the quarter, right? So by virtue of that, we ended up having buy recommendations on two of the worst performing stocks in the S&P 500, 2 years running.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And so there was a group of people, I was one of them, where it was almost like a Jerry Maguire moment, right? With the it's just a mission statement, right? It was just a mission statement. It was like, okay, the rules have changed. The environment has changed. It's a game of adjustments. We need to make an adjustment. And the adjustment our research department made, led by a couple guys in particular, they did an unbelievable job, but they got very big into channel check research. We were one of the first people in the investing world doing this. And so, yes, we still talk to IR. We still talk to CFO, CEO. We still took them on the road. And we were calling their suppliers. We were calling their distributors. A lot of them were private, so they can tell us anything they want. It's classic build out the mosaic. So by virtue of that, we found ourselves doing very good research. The business grew very fast, in part, you know, doing good research. And then you, of course, had sort of a big growth in hedge funds and sort of alternative investing through that era. Very much helped our clients in the 07, 08 timeframe. We had people positioned that. We saw it. We knew it. Personally, I was sitting 100% cash by October of 07 and warning my dad, like, you know, my parents, my in-laws, like, get out. Like, it's all going to come unhinged. Banks might fail. And they looked at me like I was a loony bin. They, you know, so that was my background, and I was a real junkie for reading all this research. As we were driving all of this data, I would take it on the weekends and I'd read it. And it's fascinating. So I started putting together a piece that was basically bottoms up macro. So it basically started from, you know, instead of sort of top down, what's CPI? What do I think is going to happen? But down, it was, okay, I just read 100 surveys across, you know, 30 different industries, bottoms up, and prices are starting to go up here, and there's bottlenecks here, or everyone's moving to China there, or whatever the case was. And I would, myself and another gentleman on the sales desk, started putting out this thematic sort of macro bottom-up piece, and it ended up being very widely read. And so I kind of learned two things from that. Number one, this dynamic of I would call almost bottoms-up aggregation, connecting of data points, that I was pretty good at it, and I enjoyed it. And then the other thing was just this, like you said, the matrix, the red pill, blue pill. I got red pilled really early, where it was like, okay, because I've been on straight commission my entire career. I was 100% commission then.
Wow.
I was 100%. I've been a business owner with FFTT for 10 years. So I've been on straight commission as a salesperson or as a business owner my entire life. And so when, you know, I was getting paid, my checks were only clearing through my firm. I was getting paid by my clients. And if my clients didn't do well, my children starved, and I wasn't going to allow that to happen. So, you know, my first month in the business, I'll never forget. My wife's like, how's the first month on commission go? I was like, I made $40 this month. She's like, going to be more than that eventually, right? I'm like, eventually, right? So, but the point is, right, you know, you talk about incentives and outcomes.
Oh, yeah.
When we have buy recommendations on two of the worst performing stocks 2 years running, this is existential to me. Like, I am going to research and going, what we're doing isn't working. We need to make an adjustment. And we did as a firm. It was great. And so I learned both, okay, this connecting the dots and building up has a lot of demand. It's really interesting. I love to do it. And then this discipline of being red pilled, you know, verify, check, you know, understanding that when the system has interests, the system isn't going to tell you, oh, by the way, we're going to miss the quarter. No, hey, how's it going? Look, things are great. We're making so much money. A week later, we missed by 20%. What happened? Oh, well, you know, so both of those things I learned early on, that was my background. And that really, you know, post 08, I started doing more and more macro as in the seat I was in, as we were getting to be a much more macro thematic driven world. And post 2014, I decided, or 2013, I decided I wanted to do this full time. Parted ways amicably with my former colleagues there. They're still very much a bottoms up research shop, and we're just kind of, you know, okay, how are we going to place this as a product? So parted ways amicably, hung on my own shingle in 2014, and I did it with no outside investors because I wanted to have complete creative control, write whatever I wanted to write. So it was scary as heck for that first 12 months. It was basically, you know, giving away product for free and hoping to make a difference. And you know, in early 2015, I sort of reached out to a lot of different people I'd been sending research to and said, look, here's, you know, we've been writing. Hopefully you've liked it. You know, I'm going to shut the paywall now. And if you're interested, you know, you need to subscribe or pay us through the soft dollar desk of whatever broker you'd like, however you want to do it. But, you know, we take Amex, Visa, whatever. And, you know, I was pleasantly surprised that people had found the work differentiated and thought provoking and helpful and money making. And so it was sort of off and running at that point. And I've been so happy. It's been such a fun ride, adventure, ups, downs, you know, to sort of be in the arena with it. And just to get to meet and interact with fascinating, brilliant people every day is really a blessing.
It really is, man. And for starters, congratulations on 10 years. This is it's a huge milestone. I'm really proud of you, man. We're heading into year four now, and it's been, you know, clearly many challenges, but also just been one of the biggest blessings of my life, like you said, and you ended on. You get to have these incredible, awesome interactions and discussions with the world's smartest people all the time, and so naturally, you're going to your ability to sort of stay abreast of all these things and kind of beat your family members, your friends, and everyone you know to sort of these key critical topics and key inflections in the market. To me, I wouldn't change it for the world. I would do what I do for a living for free. You know, just so happens that I'm good enough at it to charge a fee for it. But, you know, I'm sure you share the same passion for what it is that you do.
No, that's right. And it's, you know, I tell my boys that all the time. You know, you see these guys on TV and you hear the contract, you know, Juan Soto with his gigantic contract last week or 2 weeks ago. And everyone sees that number. And what they don't see is living, breathing, like they just the passion.
Totally.
Yes, talent, undeniable for anyone in that world, right? But it's ultimately the passion to pursue and persist and continue that leads to the success in anything.
100%. So let's dovetail into why everyone's here, and I appreciate everyone for being along on this journey with us today. Something you and I are very much passionate about is the sort of, you know, the U.S. budget deficit. You know, I think you and I sort of share the same general take, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you and I share the same general take that the U.S. is either in a slow motion fiscal crisis or likely headed into a fast motion fiscal crisis at some point over an investable time horizon. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Start the discussion off. That's fair to say. And so where, I guess I'll start my first question, where do you think we are in that process? You know, what are some of the mile markers that you've been paying attention to in recent months or quarters or years that have sort of triggered to say we are here and we're probably going to be there at some point in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for me, it's been a rolling basis, and there's different levers within that that make the situation more acute or less acute.
Yeah.
And some of that is by virtue of the structure of the system. So what I would say is kind of a linchpin to the whole thing, or a keystone to it, is the level of the dollar. And so if we start there, the issue is ultimately, foreigners have $13 trillion of dollar-denominated debt, plus some unknown amount of sort of euro-dollar borrowings, et cetera, on top of that. So they are short at least $13 trillion in dollar-denominated debt.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, they have $57 trillion of dollar assets, which are the cumulative aggregated gross assets of basically recycling deficits back into U.S. capital markets over decades. And then within that, that is about $22 trillion net, $8.5 trillion of treasuries within that number. And so when I say the fiscal crisis depends on different inputs and how acute it is, the biggest one is the dollar, because ultimately we can kind of see for the U.S., right? We know the big three expenditures. We know where they are on that. We can touch on that in a second. But the first thing is that anytime the dollar gets too high, global growth is going to slow. Foreigners that are short dollars are suddenly having to sell dollar assets in order to effectively service dollar debt, or basically import dollar denominated commodities. And they sell what they can, not what they want to necessarily. And what they can sell are treasury bonds. And so every time we've seen this pattern play out, and it's really an overriding theme of this fiscal problem, has been every time the dollar gets too strong, we start to see the long end of the treasury curve sell off in a dysfunctional manner to a certain degree. And because our debt is so high, we can only afford so much of an interest rate, right? So we can't afford much beyond 4.8, 5% on the 10-year. So the dollar is kind of that first overriding sort of lever. So basically, that's one thing I'm watching, and that's kind of right at a problematic level. Now, how do I know it's right at a problematic level as measured by DXY? Is the second thing I've really been watching since 2016, but a lot in the last 4 or 5 years, which is what I call true interest expense as a percent of receipts. So receipts is just what's the government taking and taxes all in. True interest expense is just the gross interest that we're paying on the debt plus the entitlement, the current portion of entitlements, the pay-as-you-go portion of entitlements. And anytime that true interest expense as a percent of receipts gets to 90% or so, we're having almost all of our receipts just to pay the interest and interest-like portions of our obligations, the dollar starts to strengthen because the U.S. government is basically crowding out global dollar markets with its borrowing for these expenses. And then that triggers the dollar to start moving up, which starts to trigger the dollar short, which then triggers foreigners to join the U.S. government alongside them, selling treasuries. Treasury markets start selling off, and interest rates get to a point where the U.S. government can't afford, and then Fed, Treasury, someone comes in, weakens the dollar, injects liquidity. Wash, rinse, repeat. And so we've gone through this rolling period, and those periods are compressing in terms of the span between, uh-oh, you know, rates are too high, come in, do something because the treasury markets is getting dysfunctional. And the structural nature, you know, the longer we go on, every day, 10,000 more boomers turn 65, you know, so that it rolls on. And post-Fed rate cuts, as you know, it's been very nonlinear of the repricing of interest. So the interest, you know, we've got a big refinancing coming next year. So it's been getting more acute. The thing I've been really watching in recent months, over the last 4 months, U.S. true interest expense as a percent of receipts has been 103%, which is a staggering number, particularly when you look at things like, you know, Fartcoin, which has, you know, like bigger than 40% of publicly traded companies. So like liquidity in markets is so great that Fartcoin can have an $800 million market cap, but the U.S. government still can't cover their interest expense plus their entitlements on a gross basis in the last 4 months. It's so that tells me when I then layer on $7 trillion in refi next year, I think mostly in the first half, but I could be wrong. Maybe it's evenly out. But you look at that and go, okay, this acute problem we've had, or this rolling problem, it's getting acute, and it's getting acute right now, and it's going to get more acute with each passing month.
Awesome. That was amazing, Luke. So, you know, clearly I agree with a lot of what you're saying, you know, but just in the interest of, you know, making good content here, you know, I want to play a devil's advocate, you know, a little bit with respect to something you said with respect to interest expense, you know. So, you know, I think the, you know, you and I probably talk to a lot of the same people that run very large, you know, fixed income portfolios for, you know, some multi-trillion dollar asset managers. And, you know, when I personally have conversations with them, you know, they tend to think that the acute phase of this slow motion or, you know, ongoing U.S. fiscal crisis is well in advance of us, you know, if at all, if we'll ever even truly experience that in the context of U.S. dollar hegemony. What's your sort of pushback to that sort of line, that sort of, I would say, more traditionalist line of thinking with respect to some of these U.S. budget dynamics?
Oh, I would say it goes back to that level of the dollar, which is to say, you know, it's one of these things where people say, well, what's the end game? And I've really come to abhor the phrase end game. I think it's less end game and more when's the rules change, right? The game never ends, but the rules change. And the big money's made around those rule changes. So what I would say is to look back empirically to the 2020 through 2023 timeframe, because I think it's very instructive in terms of the deficit and the acuity of the deficit fiscal problem. So what do I mean by that? Deficit blew out to $3.1 trillion in COVID. Fed comes in, they're doing massive QE, dollar bottoms out, you know, dollar peaks going into COVID, falls from, call it February, March 20 through, I want to say May, June 21, basically in a straight line. As the Fed grows its balance sheet massively, and the deficit, which peaks at $3.1 trillion in COVID, a year later is $1.4 trillion. No, what happened? How did we shrink the deficit by over half in a year? Well, it's simple. U.S. GDP grew double digits nominally. Yep. Inflation was 8% plus officially. Larry Summers estimates it might have been as high as 18% a couple years later. The Fed was capping yield. So we had significantly negative real interest rates, significant dollar weakness. And so we were able to take deficit from $3.1 trillion, to $1.4 trillion. And the true interest expense as a percent of receipts went from about 105% of receipts down to like 85%. Okay, no problem. Fed comes in and says, okay, let's tighten. We got to fight inflation. What happens from 21? You know, they finally start hiking in early 22. Stocks sell off, bonds sell off, real rates go positive, DXY peaks in 3Q22 at around 114. And 12 months later, you had the deficit doubled, nearly, or up, well, not doubled. It went from, call it, $1.4 to about $1.92 trillion. What happened? Dollar went up, stock prices went down, bonds went down, yields went up, interest expense went up, and tax receipts are highly tied to asset prices on the margin.
That's a loaded statement. Why do you say that? I think I know the answer, but I want you to explain that to the audience.
Sure. No, it's so, you know, I've evaluated the IRS the statements. And if you look at the IRS data that's aggregated, net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions alone have been running at about 200% of the annual growth in personal consumption expenditures, PCE, which is, that's just consumer spending. That's about 65-70% of the economy. So those two line items alone running at 200% of PCE growth means that mathematically, if stocks fall and stay down, U.S. consumer spending mathematically cannot grow. And if U.S. consumer spending doesn't grow, the U.S. GDP cannot grow. It's 2/3 of GDP. And critically, that's just net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions. That does not include incentive comp, stock options, et cetera, because that's all taxed as ordinary income. So the punchline was, is throughout 2022, is saying the deficit is going to blow back out because receipts are going to come in way less than they think because it's all on the margin tied to stocks. And sure enough, the deficit with the dollar going from 89 to 114, the deficit went from 1.4 trillion to 1.9 trillion, and then last year, 2.1 trillion. So all by way of background of saying to people, be it the bond funds, et cetera, like the fiscal crisis is a function of the dollar and ultimately of liquidity. And ultimately, I think it's important, the way I have dealt with it in terms of writing about it and pivot points within in research for clients has been from a starting point of the United States government is not going to allow the Treasury market to defund it. Push comes to shove. It's not going to allow an auction to fail. It's not going to allow interest expense to crowd out defense and entitlements. And therefore, anytime the dollar gets too strong that you're creating this Treasury market dysfunction, they're going to come in with more liquidity. And paradoxically, what's good for liquidity and inflation is also good for bonds because of this structural setup, at least initially, right? So you would think a weaker dollar and higher inflation 6 months from now would be bad for bonds, but it isn't. It's actually good for bonds. And taking away dollar liquidity you would think is good for bonds. It's been bad for bonds at the long end. So that's what I would say to people is, and that's why I abhor so much this view, the end game. Well, what's the end game, right? Well, you know, we saw this in 3Q23, where we had dollar up, went to 107, bonds are selling off every day, you know, stocks are selling off every, basically everything up but the dollar, or everything down but the dollar, excuse me. And we started to get that Treasury dysfunction again. We saw a 30-year auction in I think it was November last year, at like a 5 basis point tail. It was like,
yeah, huge.
You know, you're not quite, you know, huge tail. Now what happened? Yellen's like, no problem. I'll just move it all to the front end. Liquidity, boom. And, you know, that's where it gets to the point, as you said before, the red pill or blue pill, right? Where sort of the traditionalists are like, that's not QE, or the BTFP earlier, that's not QE, it's not technically inflationary, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like Tommy Lee Jones with, you know, in The Fugitive, you know, where Harrison Ford's pointing his gun at him and, you know, I didn't kill my wife. He's like, I don't care. Like yeah. That's not QE. I'm like, I don't care. Like, it's going to reverse the dynamics that were causing stocks to go down, which was the bond market dysfunctioning. The bond market is going to stop dysfunctioning with this liquidity injection, which this is. And when that happens, stocks are going to go up. Bond yields are going to go down. The dollar is going to go down. Gold's going to go up. Bitcoin's going to go up. I don't care. Like, all I care about is making money for my clients. And so that's what I would say is there's this, you know, now it's been a process. There will come a point where, like, either way, like, the Fed gets to choose, do I want to lose the long end by injecting liquidity, or do I want to lose the long end by not injecting liquidity, right? Tightening or cut. But we're not there yet. But that to me is like the, I agree with that assessment. Like we're not quite at that point yet, but we're getting closer to that point at an accelerating rate.
Yeah, no, I would have to completely agree with a lot of what you just said. One, you're dating the heck out of us with that movie reference. I appreciate it. But now we're going to be labeled as boomers by the crypto kids. But to the point on about the about how this sort of this is all playing out in an accelerated fashion, Colin, if you put up a slide 107 from our most recent macro scouting report here on the screen, we show various sort of the we break down the marketable treasury market into various investor cohorts, starting with the Fed, whose share has been declining over the past couple of years, obviously, as they've done balance sheet runoff. We're at 15% of the total marketable market in terms of that cohort. We are right around 15% as well for commercial banks. Their share had been declining as well. It sort of bottomed in late 2023, as programs like the BTFP and this sort of expectation that the Federal Reserve was going to push through interest rates regardless of how nominally hot the economy was, really started to increase their exposure to the market on top of all the short end issuance from Yellen as well. And then you've had the foreign central banks, the black line in this chart, which is down at 14%. That's been declining essentially every year since 2008. And so the residual of all those three is us, the private non-bank sector globally. We went from 36% of the marketable treasury market in late 2021 to 55% currently. And the reason that matters, none of these thresholds is a magic line in the sand, but what it ultimately tells us is that now that we own the lion's share of the market, us, the global investor community, we will naturally demand higher yields to capitalize Uncle Sam because we're not price insensitive borrowers like these guys. The Fed buys to implement monetary policy. The commercial banks buy because of regulatory reasons. Foreign central banks buy because they need some place to recycle their dollar reserves. We want units of return as investors to take risk in our portfolios. And so ultimately, in our opinion, and I think it sounds like we share this opinion, the movie is sped up. We are now in a sort of more acute phase of this process because of the fact that the ownership within the treasury market has changed so much. I assume you're shaking your head. You're nodding your head because I think you agree. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. And I think it's important from kind of two angles, right? Which is we demand a private sector is profit motivated. And we demand some measure of positive real returns, right? And not just negative real returns you know what I'm saying, right? We want to earn a return above inflation. The problem is the debt of the United States is so great, the deficits are so great that they can't afford to pay a positive real rate without going into essentially a debt spiral. And so you're sort of, now that doesn't mean immediately, but that again, it's dependent on dollar level, right? Dollar one, I don't know where DXY, it is, I don't know where it is. I don't know if it's 108 or if it's 110, but in 3Q22, it was 114. Sorry. In 3Q23, it was 107. And I would argue it's probably right around somewhere 106, 108 today, this level where
107.
There's not enough private sector balance sheet to absorb the incremental issuance without rates starting to move up in a way that drives private sector balance sheet down, right? Because on the other side, we might hold 55% of the treasuries. We also own a bunch of risk assets. And once rates get too high or start moving non-linearly higher on the treasury market, because we don't have enough balance sheet collectively, then stocks start dropping, which collectively shrinks our balance sheet while we need more balance sheet. And that is that period. That's what we saw in 3Q22 for a moment. And that's when Yellen came in and ran down TGA and the dollar went from 114 to, I want to say like 96 or 98 in a relative hurry, like in a quarter and a half. Like it was a huge weakness in the dollar. And then same thing, 3Q23, where she shifted to the front end, took the dollar off the boil, if you will. And so it's that yin and yang. Absolutely agree that the private sector is accelerating this game. And because the debt keeps going up, the level of dollar that is needed to touch off that dysfunction and balance sheet shrinkage debt spiral keeps going lower over time.
Oh, yeah.
Mechanically. So it's a tricky operating environment, that to trade, but within that you can see where sort of the, you know, the ultimate outcome is going to be is some period of significant dollar liquidity or, you know, dollar devaluation, debt reduction, something like that, that it is a big sort of big bang, but we're not to the big bang yet.
Oh, no, no. Usually I say this all the time. The monetary policymakers are, you know, they're like janitors. They show up after the party happens and they clean up. they don't beat you to the party. We usually have to go through the market and economic event first, usually market event, especially nowadays in this fiscal dominance regime where it's unlikely we have an economic event, right? We have a structurally hot economy. But what it is likely is because the growth of the global private non-bank balance sheet does not keep up with the demand for these, you know, for the demand for capital from the U.S. government. I got a couple of charts I'll share to kind of hammer that point home, and then I'll transition to a subject that I'm certain our viewers want us to talk about, which is the Doge. How do we get out of all this? So before we get to Doge, Colin, put up slide 94 real quick, where we show U.S. dollar share of the world total. You know, the reason the dollar is such a critical linchpin in this, and I certainly agree with your views on this, Luke, the reason that it's such a critical linchpin on this is because the dollar is sort of inversely correlated to the growth of the global private balance sheet, essentially. You know, 60% of cross-border bank lending, you'd need to be less than 50% for that to be positively correlated. It's 70% of the international bond market, you need to be less than 50% to be positively correlated. And then you have, it's 79% of trade invoicing. So the incremental units of balance sheet capacity around the world tend to come when the dollar is declining in price. That tends to see the corporate profit growth, the household sector savings growth, whenever you and global growth broadly, whenever you have a weaker dollar. So that's, you know, that's one of the kind of key facets of why the dollar is so important in this process. The second facet in this process with respect to balance sheet capacity is just the sheer size and growth of the U.S. public sector. Like our gross borrowing needs continue to skyrocket when you look at what we have this measure called aggregate marketable next 12-month treasury debt supply. And that's really just a function of the debt that's maturing in the next 12 months. We know what the annualized budget deficit is on a fiscal year-to-date basis. That number's wrong now because it's annualizing really high right now. But, you know, but we also know the annualized rate of divestment from the Fed's treasury portfolio. And when you put those three things together, the sum of that is somewhere around $13 trillion. Now, again, we know we're not going to annualize at 3.7% in terms of the budget deficit. It's probably fall back down to somewhere, you know, right around $2 trillion. And so you can maybe haircut that $13 trillion by $1 to $2 trillion. But we're still talking about an all-time high of roughly $11 trillion of gross borrowing need by the U.S. government. And if that were that we know that's coming, a minimum $11 trillion, we know it's coming. And so just by sheer nature of refinancing from a lower interest rate portfolio to a higher interest rate market environment, you're talking about an additional $100+ billion of incremental gross issuance or net interest expense for the U.S. government. So for the world to keep up with this almost requires a weak dollar. And the mere fact that we don't have a weak dollar tells you that this situation is getting more acute by the minute. And the final thing I'll say on all this is you have to be concerned about that, you know, maybe not early next year when we're likely to hit the debt ceiling moratorium on January 1st. We're probably going to see the TGA get drained down to toward zero in the coming months after that. And so that period in time, let's call it from Jan 2nd through, let's call it late March, early April, mid-April, who knows how long it'll last. That period in time will probably coincide with some dollar weakness. But once you get to the other side of that, when you look at the U.S. exceptionalism, the likelihood that persists, when you look at the, I would say, a widening divergence between the policy settings for the major central banks, particularly when you look at the ECB, which is getting more dovish as the Fed gets less dovish. Obviously, the People's Bank of China getting incrementally dovish. Swiss National Bank, obviously, getting incrementally dovish. The Canadian Bank, 50 basis point rate cut last week. You know, the rest of the world is starting to move in away from a monetary policy making standpoint. That almost implies wherever the level of the dollar we settle out at during the TGA spin down will probably be a higher low, and we're probably going to be off to the races on the other side of that. If you think about the relative monetary policy settings, you think about the relative economic, the relative level of interest rates that we're going to have in those economies. And ultimately, you're talking about tariffs that could also be quite structurally bullish for the dollar. And so the one thing I'll say on all this is
Colin, if you go up slide 64 here, where we show the red line just shows the world total non-financial sector debt growth lagged by 4.5 years to kind of simulate the early wave of the global refinancing cycle. And we show our 42 macro global liquidity proxy metric on a year-over-year rate of change basis as well on the blue line. And for those who may be unfamiliar, our global liquidity proxy is the global central bank balance sheet plus global broad money supply plus global FX reserves minus gold, with the bond market volatility overlay to simulate the sort of impact of changes in the repo market on liquidity. And we're sort of headed into a period where we see that there is a massive refinancing need in the coming quarters, you know, really persisting throughout much of 2025, but we may not have the global dollar liquidity we need to satisfy that. And so what it ultimately means is that Uncle Sam, going back to where we started this conversation, is this is a chart of Uncle Sam's, you know, persistent pricing out of sort of crowding out of the global private sector. Uncle Sam crowded out the global private sector in 2022. It did in Q4 18. It did in 2015-16. It did to some extent in 2011, and it certainly did to a large extent in 2008. Although there were obviously other issues at play in each of those different drawdowns in asset markets. And so this kind of takes me back to my big question is, okay, we're in an environment where those of us in the know, and I don't say that majority, we've done the research to be in the know, and we're inviting everyone to join us on this journey. Those of us in the know recognize that we live in a world where that requires incremental debasement of the US dollar to keep the system functioning. But we don't necessarily live in the world whereby the monetary authority recognizes that, or certainly recognizes that in a linear fashion. And so it kind of takes us back to where I want to take the conversation next is, how do we get out of this world? Like, is Doge going to be the solution to kind of fix all this? What's your thought on Doge? Will they be successful? I'll kind of tee you up and let you go.
Yeah, and I would accentuate what you highlighted with kind of the initial point I made, which is, you know, that dollar liquidity squeeze, foreigners are going to join, you know, they're going to layer on top of that next 12 months issuance of 11 or 13 trillion. They're short dollars. They got $8.5 trillion, and they'll sell those $8.5 trillion in treasuries till their hands bleed, you know, on top of all that, right? So the real number could end up being as high as $19 to $21 trillion of effective supply, right? They're not going to sell all that $8 trillion at once, but just for, right? So, okay. So Doge, and how do we get out of this? If they try to do Doge, or if they announce tariffs, basically our view has been in recent weeks/months, anything that drives the dollar up too much more than here is going to kick off what we called 2022 and 3Q23 investing regime, which is dollar up, everything else down. Mm-hmm. Stocks down, bonds down, everything down.
That's what we call inflation here in terms of our market review, not casting prices.
Okay.
Yep.
And tariffs initially will drive the dollar up. That's a problem. Doge specifically, I've been very, very vocal about this. If they try to cut before they devalue the dollar or otherwise reduce the debt in a very dramatic fashion, you know, virtually overnight, and there's ways you can do that, they will touch off the worst crisis, in my opinion. It'll be 3Q22 or be 22 again, 3Q23 again, maybe worse. I don't think it'll last long because I don't think politically the president will sit there and say, oh, gee, sorry, Elon knocked your 401k down 30%, but don't worry, I'm still awesome. Like, I think he's going to throw Elon out on his ear and Vivek out on his ear and reverse anything they had just done. And you can see this because it will drive, these cuts will drive exactly what you just described. You know, the government is too big, 25% of GDP, and we're running a 7% of GDP deficit, right? So let's just pretend that they cut spending by 3%. Let's just say they cut 5 points of GDP. Let's just say it would take it from 7 to 2% GDP deficit. That means you take 5 points of GDP growth out now. That's going to spike the dollar as you crowd out global dollar markets because growth slows. That is ultimately going to result in a recession, taking 5 points out. Recession, dollar spikes. The last three recessions saw U.S. deficit rise by 600 basis points of GDP, 800 basis points of GDP, 1,200 basis points of GDP. So paradoxically, if they don't devalue the dollar or debt first and try to cut the deficit, they will end up increasing the deficit. And empirically, we have experience with this. We saw this with Obamacare in 2014. Obamacare was rolled out, said Wall Street Journal, December 2014, Obamacare will reduce the deficit. It's going to push healthcare costs from the government down to consumers, right? Efficiency, DOGE. This is just DOGE before DOGE. Makes perfect sense. What really happened? 2015, well, the government is not paying for any of this stuff. There's no fund they're draining. They don't have them. It's just they're just creating the money to do it. So now you're taking created money off balance sheet liabilities and assigning a real world liability to a private balance sheet. My healthcare premiums went up 30%. Okay, well, we're going to go out to dinner a few less times. Maybe I'm going to extend my car for another year. I'm not going to buy a new car. I'm not going to go on, I'm not going to go on vacation. This happened economy-wide. 2015, the economy slows meaningfully due to a drive for efficiency, due to the DOGE 1.0, which was Obamacare. And 16 months later, the U.S. fiscal deficit as a percent of GDP was higher after the U.S. government had cut spending on healthcare via Obamacare. And the same thing will happen except on steroids, because the cuts being talked of are bigger and the debt is higher and leverage cuts both ways. So if they try to doge, they will blow. They like, you're going to want to own dollars and nothing else. Now, with a big asterisk, if we have a Sunday night surprise, if Besant comes out and does something to devalue the dollar, that's different. If DOGE is achieved by, we're running at a gross interest of, say, pro forma $36 trillion, 4% average rate by the end of next year, we'll say, if the Fed doesn't slash rates, that's a trillion, $1.44 trillion. So let's just say $1.4 trillion in interest, gross basis, pro forma for 2025. The Fed cuts rates to zero, and Treasury shifts issuance to all at the front end. To make an extreme example, and you know what's going to happen, right? That's why you're laughing. That is technically DOGE. That will reduce the deficit by $1.4 trillion.
Yeah.
And the release valve will simply be the dollar and inflation. And that's, so not only will we immediately get the technical impact of that, but then we go back to the example from earlier of COVID, right? Where we were able to get the deficit from 3.1 to 1.4 trillion over an 18-month span by keeping rates at zero and the Fed doing QE and inflation going to 8, and away we went. Same dynamic. The tax receipts will explode with economic activity, nominal GDP. Nominal GDP will probably run 12%. Inflation will probably be 9, and rates will be zero, and they'll be financing it all in the bill markets, and stocks will probably double. Gold and Bitcoin will go nuts. And when the government tallies up the tax take on all of that and reports their deficit numbers in September, certainly by September 2026, maybe by September 2025, they'll be running a surplus. Voila. while this is an extreme example,
I think
it's useful in terms of understanding the levers of what they can do, which is to say, if the Fed doesn't have to cut all the way to zero, they just have to cut when they shouldn't be. Let's say they cut another 50 basis points over the next 3 months, with nominal GDP printing 6 to 7, and with inflation bottoming out at 4 and ticking back up over 4.5, 5, and they still cut, the dollar will respond. And as the dollar responds and stocks respond and Bitcoin responds and gold responds, private sector balance sheet will expand as the deficit shrinks. And that's why I say paradoxically, you would think, oh my God, the long end's gonna crash. Well, the Fed hasn't sold a 10-year on net, a 10-plus year bond on net. They've sold a little bit gross, but they haven't sold a 10-year plus bond on net since 2010. Mm. So the long end is like, it's sort of a real market, but it's sort of not, it's not. And so you can see the lever. And so why is this useful? It's really useful because if you can understand the levers, like this is what they're going to do. Now, I have a very high conviction they're going to do some form of this.
Of course.
I have no conviction that, between, to your point about the air pocket, that they understand this, that they all understand this. So I think some of them absolutely do. And I have no conviction over the next 3 to 4 months of, A, we still are a month plus out from the inauguration. B, there's sort of a lag time for confirmations and what have you. And C, there's a political process. There are, like, I got people threatening me on Twitter for saying, let's just do this. Like, oh, you want to devalue the dollar. You're like, those are threatening me with physical violence, which tells you there is a, like, there's a political process to getting from here to there. The political process, to use your phrase, it's not going to be linear. So do they need an air pocket to convince certain people? Maybe. Like, nothing convinces someone who thinks cutting first is the right thing to do than the stock market down 20% in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. That'll do it.
100%. 100%. And you know, I've been of the view that it's probably good policy to come in and kitchen sink the economy in order to create the conditions required politically to create the actual, you know, structural cuts to the deficit that we all ultimately all clamor for here as investors and most of us as part of American society. People with kids, nobody wants the $2 trillion, $3 trillion deficits in perpetuity. This is obviously very self-destructive. And so, you know, in my opinion, if they're smart, take advantage of the refinancing air pocket. Blame Biden. Just say, hey, this is all his fault. You know, that's what I would do if I was, joining the Oval Office on Jan 20th. So you said a lot of quite a few things that I wanted to sort of pull on some threads there. One, you mentioned this sort of Obamacare experience, and this is just completely anecdotal, but it really resonates with me. I wrote my senior thesis at Yale on how the United States as a capitalist society cannot have a single pay fair healthcare system, because ultimately it would crowd out the rest of the resources in the economy and it causes significant inflation in the economy. And what it was about 15, 16, 17 years later, it seems to be very accurate. And oh, by the way, Dr. Henry Kissick, who's the guy who wrote the Medicare bill, gave me an A+ on that thesis paper. So I'm really proud of that. So secondary, that's not gonna help anybody make money in financial markets. So my apologies for that. Going back to this concept of DOGE. So with respect to, let me kind of summarize some of the things you said that just to make sure that audience hammered home, because I think this is really critical. You said, if you just start cutting without getting a significant devaluation in the dollar, you're probably gonna wind up causing an economic event and a significant downturn in the economy that ultimately sort of shoots yourself in the foot. You go back, you cited the last three the downturns in the economy. We've had a budget deficit widening by 600 basis points, 800 basis points, 1200 basis points. So it's essentially, we can't cut our way. We can't have austerity to be successful. It's unlikely to be very successful in the context of an economy that, you know, federal expenditures are 24% of the U.S. economy. So that's number one. Number two, then, if we devalue the dollar enough to create the balance sheet conditions associated with the global private non-bank sector, we could have some sort of reasonable success in this, because ultimately we have this economy that's sort of, you know, hyper financialized and, you know, very tethered to the performance of capital markets. And if we could sort of power through from that perspective, we could potentially see that. And that would ultimately require some significant devaluation of the dollar. I heard you talk about potential revaluation of the U.S. gold holdings. Trump's out of recent days talking about a strategic Bitcoin reserve, potentially achieving the same type of dynamic. So those are the types of things we could see. It strikes me as very odd that we would get to a place where there's political air cover to significantly devalue the dollar in the absence of having a significant market event or a significant economic event or both. So that seems unlikely from today's starting point. And so my sort of next question in the context of those two kind of extreme examples you provide, and I appreciate your use of hyperbole, because it sort of hammers the point home that there's no easy path forward. And my key takeaway when I kind of unpack a lot of the numbers on the budget deficit, you know, I kind of go back to this place where, you know, we are in a fourth turning. And if you think about a fourth turning, kind of the first part of the fourth turning is, you know, it starts with this sort of, for lack of a better word, the voting population is pissed off. And there's a lot of division in society and they're demanding institutional change because they're pissed off. This chart here, Colin, if you throw slide 88 from our most recent macro scouting report here, we show labor share of national income versus capital share of national income. Labor share is all the way down at the bottom at 52%, used to average right around 56% in the, you know, four decades to 2000. And I would argue NAFTA 1993, China and WTO in 2001, was the reason why we've seen this sort of relationship between labor and capital inflect. You know, capital, if you look at corporate profits as a percentage of GDP, are up at 13% from a long-term mean of 9%. And that 400 basis point swing doesn't seem like much, but what it ultimately equates to is about $1.2 trillion per annum of lost income for the household sector that has essentially become a regressive tax on the household sector that we're giving to the corporate sector in the form of corporate profits. And so that's about 11%. If you break it down per private sector employee, it's right around a lost 11% of annual private sector income. So the median American family, the working class American family, feels this. This is why the electoral we've seen so much political volatility in recent years since the beginning of this fourth turning, which my former colleague and one of my mentors, Neil Howe, would argue, kind of catalyzed with the GFC. This is why everyone's so pissed off. And this is my opinion why Trump is such a politically popular president. He's the most popular Republican president of all time, by the way. He's more popular than Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan. So, I think in my opinion, this chart explains why he's so popular. And so this takes me back to where I wanted to kind of end on and kind of get your thoughts on, which is when I look at this budget deficit, or it's not the budget deficit, I just look at the U.S. federal budget dynamics. I don't know where they're going to cut in terms of, the most populist president since FDR coming in with a very hyper-populist mandate to fix that, the slide, that I just showed in terms of the labor share of national income being down on lows. I have you, cite you FFTT, true interest expense, down here at my table, give you appropriate credit for some excellent research here. If you look at true interest expense, we're compounding at 13% per annum. 13% per annum over the last few years. So if you're going to have austerity, not only do you need to have some sort of austerity, you need to counter that growth of that on top of just actually reducing the budget deficit, because we know that that's going to continue to grow as a function of U.S. Demographic dynamics and as a function of the U.S. interest rate regime. Those things are going to continue growing, maybe not at 13% per annum, but they're certainly the growth of our, in fact, if you go and look at our, where were we at here in terms of, if you look, next in 2025, we have 160,000 people joining the retirement age population here in the U.S. per month. And that compares to 32,000 people per month joining the working age population here in the United States. So we know these, true interest expense is going to continue to compound at a very high level in the context of those demographic and interest rate dynamics. And so when you add things like Medicaid, welfare, and veterans benefits, which I would argue are the three most populous parts of the U.S. government budget, I don't think there's a lot of political will, at least not early on in the Trump presidency, to cut those things. And so you add your true interest expense metric plus what I would call those three things, those populous categories, the other three categories, to the seven total categories, that's 90% of the budget. That 90% of the budget is compounding at right around 3% per year. So you got to beat that whole bogey if you're trying to create real austerity. And ultimately, what it means is that everything else that the federal government does is only right around just north of $700 billion, and that's compounding. It's been compounding at minus 15% per annum on a trailing 3-year CAGR basis. And so we're already seeing a shrinking of the U.S. government outside of the things that, a populist president, the most populist president since FDR, is probably not going to cut. And so it's kind of a hot potato I'm leaving you with, but where the hell else are they going to find the cuts? Especially in the context, we're not even talking about the tax cuts we're likely to see, but just in the context of the expenditure side of the budget debt balance, where do you think they're going to be able to cut, if at all?
Oh, this is why I have such high conviction that the dollar will be lowered at some point next year. And I have no view in the next 3-4 months and totally agree with the airport, but I am as high a conviction as is possible, maybe in my career, that it'll happen, because I would layer onto what you just laid out, which I completely agree with, including, your numbers are incredible. I some of these numbers I've never heard before, but I see the outcome. But to hear your numbers, I see the output of them when I look at the data, to see them describe that, it's untenable. And I would layer onto that untenability, Tom McClellan had a great post the other day. We highlighted it for our clients, which is, if you go back to 1933, anytime the United States tax receipts all in have gone above 18% of GDP, the U.S. has gone into recession. Even in 2022, we didn't have an official recession, but they got above 18%, and we had two straight quarters of GDP decline. Now, remember what I just said about GDP decline. If you have any policy that America chooses that causes GDP to decline is going to send the deficit up as a percent of GDP by somewhere between 600 and 1200 basis points of GDP. So your deficit will explode higher nonlinearly, paradoxically, on any policy that drives a recession. So to answer your question, you just ran through all the math, nothing to cut.
Yeah.
We're basically at 18% on tax hikes.
Oh boy.
You can't, you were stone's throw. You can't increase taxes without causing a recession that will cause a deficit to paradoxically rise rather than fall. And so what is there to do? The only thing that's left to do is devalue the dollar. Full stop. That's the only thing you can do. You can't cut without causing a recession. You can't tax without causing a recession. All you can do, because to your point, you need private sector balance sheet to grow 13% just to stay even and not start crowding dollar higher.
Yeah.
And it tells you that it can't be some little dink and doink type of devaluation. It's going to have to be like a systemic Sunday night surprise. Now, could the Trump, Bitcoin, that something like that, gold revaluation, which we've talked about before, maybe, but it's the dollar has to be lower or the Trump popularity, he will go from the most popular ever to the least popular ever in the shortest period of time.
100%. He is not going to put up with that whatsoever.
No, he does not like being unpopular.
Not at all. Not even for 2 minutes. So I guess my final takeaway on this, and I'll let you go, because you've been monopolizing your time. You've been so gracious, brother. My final takeaway on this is that, I caught some flack over the weekend about, Doge and, kind of my skepticism regarding the likely success of Doge from the starting point, right? It's very likely they're going to find enough, quote unquote, efficiency when you look at the crack, you crack open the egg with respect to federal government, the expenditures. They're not going to find enough efficiency to create the kind of cost savings that the deficit reduction that we are clamoring for as members of American society and members of the financial markets, right? It's very unlikely that they're going to be successful just cutting enough. One, there's probably not enough stuff to cut from the perspective of a populist president. Two, there's probably not enough stuff to cut in the context of the things that they cannot cut, compounding at 13%. So you'd have to obviously be taking a draconian axe to everything else to even just offset that, let alone actually achieve deficit reduction. So that's been my key takeaway. And, so I got a lot of pushback on that because there is a pocket of, investors, and I'm guessing they generally wear red ties. I have my purple tie on because I'm neither Republican nor Democrat. I represent, the centrist view, the data-driven centrist view. And the data-driven centrist view of me suggests that, this is a very big problem that I'm not so sure that they're going to be able to have an easy solution for. And so once we recognize that this is a big problem that we're not going to have an easy solution for, let's start putting on our big boy pants and actually having a serious discussion about serious solutions for this very big problem. It's not going to be Elon Musk tweeting his thoughts out every 5 minutes about quote unquote efficiency. We have to solve a very, very big problem in this country. And I'm really grateful that we have folks like you, Luke, leading the charge on some of this, these really insightful discussions, my friend. Appreciate you.
Oh, likewise. I appreciate it. And I agree entirely. I mean, ultimately, I go back to an interview that David Sirota, I think, did with the Washington Post at the time with Senator Obama before he was elected president.
Yep.
And Sirota was pushing him, and look, you're backing away from Medicare for All. Why? And one of the things Obama said was, 1, 2, 3 million people employed in 2006 in healthcare administration. What are they going to do? People forget these second derivative effects. I can highlight another example beyond Obamacare of the cuts of efficiency, right? Sending American jobs and factories to China under WTO was absolutely 100% efficiency. It reduced labor costs, it reduced factory costs, environmental costs. It took 10% of manufacturing jobs offline basically within 2 years. We papered over that for a time by giving them subprime mortgage loans and home equity lines to buy bass boats and houses. And then that blew up and it ended up on the Fed's balance sheet 5 years later, 6 years later. Same dynamic here. All of these government workers, healthcare administrators, et cetera, that touch that 25% of federal GDP, they all have mortgages. They have house, car loans, student loans. And when they lose their jobs, they aren't going to get hired on as welders the next day making 200 grand. There is a lag. There is a retraining. And we also learned, by the way, here in the Midwest, a lot of times there is never a retraining. What there is an epidemic of ODs and alcohol and suicides, sadly. And so that dynamic, again, I don't think is by those people just pushing the cuts. They're all for it. But I can think of little more politically toxic to this country than running DOGE without devaluing the dollar, firing a bunch of people, T plus 6 to 12 months, you're going to start having banking crises as these government employees stop making their money. And then the Fed comes in and bails out the banks.
Holy.
Like we're already seeing things, and you know what I'm talking about, that are breaking, they're breaking the Overton window in terms of the political extremism in this country the last couple of weeks in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even imagine the political reaction to doing DOGE and then bailing out the banks within 12 months, which I would say that'd probably be the over-under. If you do DOGE without devaluing, you will be bailing out American banks within probably 12 months, give or take. And if you do that, you're done. The Republicans will lose in a landslide in 2026. And Trump will be completely discredited, completely most least popular president. So like the order of operations, like you said, you got to put your big boy pants on. The Americans always do the right thing after we've exhausted all the alternatives. We have exhausted the alternatives. Devaluing the dollar, FDR did it, Nixon did it. Drive the growth, fix the balance sheet, restructure, then you have the balance sheet capacity. We can get more efficiency, but efficiency, you fire someone today, they stop paying the mortgage tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the efficiency benefit doesn't show up for 12 to 24 months minimum.
Totally.
So you've got to create the balance sheet capacity, that runway of 12 to 24 months, if you're going to do the DOGE, because otherwise you're just going to trigger a bank crisis and a political crisis 12 months out when the banks get bailed out again.
Yeah, and everyone who doesn't agree with that, just go back and look at the European sovereign debt crisis. This is exactly what we were talking about. We were talking about with Greece and with Spain and Italy and the quote-unquote pigs, if everyone remembers that. I remember it very vividly, having traded through that experience in my career. So that's our take on this. I'm really pumped for this to get out into the rest of the world, because I want to get everyone else's takes on this. I don't think you and I think you would agree, Luke, we don't have all the answers, the two of us, but I think what we're trying to do is do the proper research to get closer to the answer than the rest of the world who's not paying attention to these things, and help our clients get closer to the answer so that we can see the kind of game evolve in slow motion like any high-level athlete would, right? The better you are, the more prepared you are for this stuff, the more you can sort of spot these things in real time and make the appropriate pivots in your portfolio when the market tells you it's time to make those pivots. And so I'm looking forward to the market telling us it's time to make those pivots, man. Look, this one's freaking awesome. Freaking awesome. We're definitely going to have you back on at some point in the future, man. Can we tell folks where we can go to find you?
Absolutely. FFTT-LLC.com for more information about our institutional and mass market products. And then, as you know, on X at Luke Grohman.
Absolutely, brother, man. Thank you so much. And happy holidays to your family.
Likewise, you and yours.
Yeah, appreciate you, man. And I'll end on this. I know I've been ranting, but your energy is infectious. I can tell that you have a great Midwestern background and culture behind you, who as a person and what it is that you do and your passion for helping others. And so I just want to say I thank you and appreciate what you're doing out there, man. I'm looking forward to continue to collaborate.
Likewise, I appreciate that.
Appreciate you, brother. Be well.
All right. Likewise, you too. Take care.
Disclaimer, 42 Macro does not provide, and no portion of our content purports to be, individualized or specific investment advice. And 42 Macro does not provide investment advice to individuals. All information provided by 42 Macro is general in nature and is made without regard to individual levels of sophistication or investment experience, investment preferences, objectives, or risk parameters, and without regard to the suitability of the content for individuals or entities who may access it. No information provided by 42 Macro should be construed as an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor should it be construed as tailored or specific to you or consumer thereof. You understand and agree that our content does not constitute specific recommendations of any particular investment, security, portfolio, transaction, or strategy, nor does it recommend any specific course of action is suitable for any specific person or entity or group of persons or entities. At any point in time, the employees of 42 Macro may own a portion of or all the ETF securities discussed in 42 Macro Research content. 42 Macro Research content is based upon information from sources believed to be reliable. 42 Macro is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information, nor is it responsible for the accuracy or authenticity of the information upon which it relies.